Welcome to the Healing Trauma Podcast, a space for those who are healing from complex and developmental trauma. Introducing your host, Monique Coven, a certified trauma recovery coach, survivor, and thriver. The intent of the podcast is to provide helpful information with insight that can validate, encourage, and support you on your healing journey. You're going to hear stories from other survivors and trauma experts, featuring therapists, coaches, and practitioners. We will open up the conversation on effective trauma healing modalities, practices, and tools. If you are interested in trauma recovery coaching, as well as recommended books and healing resources, head over to www.thehealingtraumapodcast.com. And now, here is your host, Monique Coven.
Welcome back. On today's episode, I am having back clinical psychologist and therapist, Dr. Tamara McClintock-Greenberg. And I wanted Tamara to come back because she is not only an expert in talking about trauma, but she also has extensive experience on working with older adults and their children regarding coping with dementia and other medical illness. So I wanted to talk today about something we haven't talked about, and that is caring for our aging parents or our parents who did not care for us. So whether they're aging or have a chronic illness or they've developed a chronic illness and suddenly they're in a position where they need support. This happens as our parents age. And for those of us who've had trauma with these parents, it can be extremely challenging and difficult. So I brought her on to talk a little bit about this topic. It's a very big topic, and we're not going to be able to go into, you know, there's so many different facets, but we will touch on it. And it is something to think about. So now on to the episode with Tamara. Hi, Tamara. Welcome back to the podcast.
Thanks so much for having me again. I'm delighted to see you.
Yeah, I'm really happy to talk today about a topic that I think is so important to think about. And I know that the population that listens to this particular podcast, the majority of people, from what I see from stats, is between the ages of 28 to about 35. Although, okay. I mean, I do hear from people that are older and even some that are younger, but like the majority. And sometimes I think, well, is this topic, which is the topic of caregiving when we've had trauma or with the particular caregiver that we had, is this going to be something that is relevant? And I thought, you know what? It is relevant because it's going to happen. And right. I wanted to talk about that because that is something that I haven't seen talked about much.
Right.
And I wanted to talk to you about that because I know that you have experience in that. You've worked with that population. I've worked with that population too, by the way, as a social worker. But you as a psychologist, you've written books on it, and I just thought that would be great to bring you back and to talk with you about it.
Thank you. You know, I was thinking about what you just said in terms of the demographics of, you know, younger people aren't there yet. And I was thinking, you know, I hope they're not there yet. But my experience in working in medical hospitals has been that, you know, unfortunately, illness can happen at different points. And young people do sometimes end up needing to deal with an illness in a parent because unfortunately, illness happens and it's something that can't be controlled. The other thing I was thinking about, though, which dovetails nicely with this topic, is for so many of us, you know, who identify with a history of trauma, there's a way that caretaking has always been a part of the picture, you know, and not that caretaking a parent is traumatic per se, but, you know, people who don't have great childhoods often find themselves needing to be watchful and prepared. And also, you know, you learn how to take care of a parent who, for example, might be unpredictable or unstable. So it's almost like caretaking behaviors can start really, really young in people. And then when, and you know, when and if a parent gets sick and a person chooses to be involved with that parent, that caretaking instinct can kick in right away in ways that can be helpful and in ways that can be unhelpful.
Oh yeah. And I'm so glad you said that, because I was thinking of like the caregiving as they get older, but you are absolutely right. Some people have had sick parents that continue to be ill, or they develop an illness and then they're in that position of, okay, what do I do now? And so it's very interesting what you were saying about, you know, maybe they were, people are used to sort of that role. They just go right into it. And yes, there's so many things and so many places that we can go with this, because the first thing I want to say is like, just the idea of the name caregiving, caregiving to your caregiver. And I, both of those are in quotations, right?
Yeah.
You know, especially when you've had a history of trauma, developmental trauma, there was no real caregiving, but they're called caregiver. And right. Now there's this sort of society expectation to look to the children for the caregiving of the caregiver that didn't right. really give any care, but now you're in a position where they expect you to provide caregiving. I mean, right. just that alone, I mean, can really bring up so much.
Yeah, no, I think that's exactly right. And I mean, I've seen people handle it very differently. Some people choose consciously to just not be aggressively involved. You know, maybe they felt like, look, I didn't get what I needed. And, you know, there's only so much I can do. For example, if a parent has dementia, you know, they might choose to be less involved. Another thing that can happen, and I guess I've seen this more just given having worked in the in hospitals and in long-term care facilities, is sometimes you can see people who, out of a sense of having not gotten what they should have gotten, they kind of try at the end of a parent's life to do all of the things that they didn't get. Almost as if they, I call them super caretakers. Like if they become a super caretaker with their parents, then I think there's a wish that they'll somehow get back some of the things that they didn't get. And I think that can be a really fraught situation for people. Now, depending on the relationship, there are absolutely situations where some people didn't have a great childhood. And if a parent falls ill and they're in a caregiving role, you can find that some repair can take place, that there can be conversations about what happened and why. And sometimes, although this doesn't happen as much as we'd like it to, but sometimes, you know, kids can even get an apology or some sense of a parent understanding what they didn't get right. That to me is like the ideal outcome. And I think what everybody wants, right? You know, because we don't get a do-over of our childhoods. But at the end of a parent's life, the stakes are higher because it's like you realize, well, now I'm never really going to get it. And so, but if you can get a little bit of a parent's understanding and acknowledgement of the ways that they failed you, hurt you, mistreated you, that can go a long way actually in helping people heal. Unfortunately, that doesn't happen a lot. I wish I could give you a percentage on how often that happens.
Oh, I know. I know. And I'm just thinking about, I had this conversation with someone recently. It's an episode that I'll be putting out. And she did have that with her parents. And we were saying, like, it's rare. And even Judith Herman, who was her, way back when, was her actual therapist.
Oh, wow.
I know. It's incredible. She says, unfortunately, it's rare. Does happen. But it's not as common as we would like. And my feelings, and again, this is just my feelings and thoughts, is that if you have a parent that was not able to actually see or feel because they don't have that component for whatever reason, it's just not there, then, you know, how do you expect them to see it now? And that's a hard pill to swallow. But it's true. So my heart really goes out, and maybe we can talk a bit about that. Like, you know, what kinds of things can you say for those children who are now adults and they're in a position now where their parent is ill or older or has dementia and people are looking to the family or the children to do something or to partake? What do you think? What are some things to consider that would be helpful for someone with a history of trauma to consider?
That, I mean, I think the number one thing is to be aware of how incredibly, you know, potentially triggering and overstimulating the situation is going to be. And to really, if you, and equally as important, I guess, is to realize it's a conscious choice. You can choose to be involved however much you want, you know? Now, some people will say, there's absolutely no other option than for me to be involved all in. And so, okay, that's fine. I understand. I get it. Then you really want to try to work with ways that you can make sure that you're paying attention to how you're handling the stress. So for example, one of the things that you see a lot in the literature is that caregivers, long-term caregivers, so a typical example would be somebody whose parent has dementia, either in the same city or state or even out of state, there's just so much work that goes into dealing with, you know, if they move into a care facility or dealing with doctor's appointments and caretakers and all of that. Even if you're not in the home providing the actual caregiving, if you're a project manager, if you will, trying to take care of stuff, it's so much work. It's like a full-time job. And so I always tell people to try as much as you can to be really mindful about what you can and can't do in terms of your time. Second, to make sure that you build in time to take care of yourself. Of course, easier said than done. And then third is, if there are siblings, if there are other family members, is there a way to work together to get help? What I've seen a lot is I've seen one sibling that'll kind of step up and do all the things, and then other siblings might sit back. And that is a really difficult situation, because at the end of a parent's life, there's this thing that happens with our siblings where these old competitive feelings can come up in terms of wanting the parent's attention. And so when a parent is sick or there's caregiving involved, there can be a lot of intense fighting among siblings. So trying to figure out a way, if possible, and it isn't always possible, but trying to figure out a way, if possible, to work out some kind of collaboration with siblings so that people can share responsibilities. Again, much easier. All this is easier said than done. You know, the main thing is just to be aware that it's going to be an incredibly difficult, albeit temporary, you know, position that you're in, but it's a very difficult, it's one of the hardest things in life. And you don't really know what it's like till you go through it.
That's interesting that you say that, because someone just said that to me today. I was at a funeral today. And so some people were going through some of those things that you're talking about. And one of my friends who has a mom who has dementia, has Alzheimer's, she was saying, you know, you get all this advice from people who've never been through it.
Right.
They have no idea of the stress and everything that goes on. But I want to come back to something, because I think that one of the really things we understand about complex trauma is that it takes a life. It's a life of healing. I mean, it doesn't end. You're healing. And choice, not being able to have a choice as a child was a huge, I mean, that's one of the big things with trauma. There was no choice, there was no agency. And to be put in a position again to feel that way, it just it just seems like it's not fair. And I think that it's, I'm trying to think about how we're able to really talk about this for trauma survivors in a way where they can feel empowered. And I know there's no easy answer, but I think that part of us, part of it might be standing up to society's expectations and being brave. I don't know.
Yeah. Well, no, I mean, I think you're right. I was thinking as you were talking though, that, you know, there's so many cultural aspects too. Like in certain cultures, there's just, you know, certain family members, like they're kind of assigned at birth, like you will be my caretaker when I get older, you know? So it, you know, societal expectations, cultural expectations, I think all of those things are difficult. You know, what I always tell people is, at the end of the day, you need to figure out what you feel like you can live with. And so, like, I think, you know, for some people, like, I just kind of, I'm walking them through like a thought exercise. Like, all right, well, let's say you're doing X, Y, and Z, but you're not going to do A and B. After your mom passes, how do you think it'll be that you didn't do A and B, but you did do these other things? Is that, again, none of us can really imagine it very well until we go through it, but can you at least play with it? You know? And then also, I think really trying to think about, to the extent that people can, and it's so hard, but really trying to think about what does get given up in intense caregiving roles. I've seen people lose their jobs. I've seen people whose marriages have fallen apart. You know, they've given up everything, you know, to be with their parent for, you know, in dementia, people live a really long time. And so it can be years. And so I think just encouraging people to be really, you know, thoughtful about, these are the choices, these are the consequences. After it's, you know, over, what is it going to be like for you? Can you imagine a life after this is over? Sometimes, you know, you can try to talk with people about some of the reasons they feel so conflicted about caregiving, or why they might be throwing themselves into it without, you know, really being able to think about taking care of themselves. But oftentimes people get, you know, they kind of go down this rabbit hole. And so just trying to get people to stop and even be a little bit mindful about what they're doing, it goes a long way, but it can be really hard to do.
I really like that about the exercise that you do. It just goes to show how important and how wonderful it would be if there was this kind of support available for caregivers, you know? So needed, so needed. But even to think through these things,
right? You know? One of the things that I think is crucial, both in my work with clients in this situation, but also the amazing support of groups, like groups for caregivers, either formal or informal groups of caregivers, is being able to talk about the negative thoughts and the negative feelings you have about being in the role. That, I think, if people can never voice frustration or, you know, wishing they weren't in this situation, it can lead to really negative consequences in terms of, you know, people bottling up normal negative emotions. And so I think I mean, you're so right. I wish our society was more supportive of people having, well, negative emotions of all kinds, right? Without being told that you're crazy, you know, especially for us as women, but especially around caregiving, for like creating a space for people to know that you're entitled to feel incredibly ambivalent about this, and you're entitled to not even want to do it, and you're entitled to not do it.
Yeah, that's really, really good. Wow. I just, you know, I think I am coming to the age where this is happening. And someone I know was talking about how she went through 2 years of this to the point where she was beyond depleted. And she just was saying, I will never do this to my kids. So you could sort of see the generation sort of changing, because we're realizing the impact that this can have. But there was no support at all for her in terms of anybody asking her, are you okay?
Right, exactly. No, and that's what's so hard about it is people don't, because people, you know, these kinds of situations related to death and illness in general, you know, especially in American culture, I can't speak to all other cultures, but certainly in American culture and Western cultures, I think in general, people just don't want to hear about it. And so, you know, I mean, I have so many stories of people who are caretakers getting together with friends, and they would love to talk about what they've experienced with their mom in the last 24 hours. You know, a parent who gets confused and calls 911 from the nursing home, or, you know, calls their child in the middle of the night 5 times because they're worried about something. And, you know, but people don't really want to hear these stories because people don't want to think about illness. They don't want to think about being in this position. So it's incredibly isolating. And just to piggyback on something you said a couple minutes ago, caregivers are at great risk, actually, for depression, increases in substance use, and even their own negative health effects. Long-term caregiving is associated with negative health outcomes. So it's crucial that people find the right kind of social support. And I guess it's like everything we say with social support. It's not enough to have people around. You actually have to find people who can show up and listen and not minimize your experience.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. I was going to ask you something else, but I lost that thought with regards to, you know, our thoughts and the way the expectations. Oh, I think I remember now. You were talking, well, you were talking about like the importance of, or I was thinking about, you know, we have to understand the implications that it potentially, like, to think about the implications that it can have, or how we would feel, or what other ways, like you talked about, well, it could affect a marriage, or it could affect, you know, the caregiving. And I was thinking, as you were speaking, well, what about the impact that it has on your mental health? If it's so triggering that it's bringing you right back, is that something that you are prepared to go through?
Exactly. I think just having that be a topic of conversation, that if you do choose to do it, okay, but it's gonna be really painful. You might have flashbacks. You might have memories of things. Your parent, you know, might not be as gracious, probably won't be as gracious as you would like them to be, right? Because, you know, we all have this fantasy that, okay, you know, and this is, I remember learning this in my training too, quite frankly, dealing with older or dying patients. There was this idea that you could get people to do a life review at the end of their lives, or to repair things with their families. I mean, that was like the teaching and that I had. And then I started working and I'm like, this never happens. Like this rarely, rarely happens that there's this like happy outcome and the kids feel better about everything. So I think really making it clear that if you're going to do it, it might be a thankless job, and you really need to stay in touch with the wishes, right? And separate the wish from reality, right? The wish is, oh, my mom is finally going to tell me she loves me. The reality is, no, most people die the way they live. And she wasn't that nice to me when I was a kid. Why would I expect for her to be nice to me now?
Yes, I think that's so good. I wrote that down, you know, separating your wishes from reality. Yeah. So, what else do you want to share with us about, you know, that comes to your mind when it comes to chronic illness, trauma, and relationships?
I think, you know, if somebody decides to be in a caregiving role, or, and even if they aren't in a formal caregiving role and their parent does, you know, get sick, even if it doesn't require a lot of caretaking, loss of any kind for anyone who's had a traumatic background, loss of any kind is a trigger for PTSD or complex PTSD symptoms, right? So in this case, we're talking about, you know, potential loss of a parent or a caregiver, but the reality is losses of all kinds can be very triggering. So keeping that in mind, considering getting into therapy, finding the right kind of social support and all the self-care stuff, you know, that we all know, but it's really hard to do. One of the things that I always used to recommend to people who were taking care of someone in medical settings is, you know, you have to do the basic things. You have to take time to go downstairs to the cafeteria and eat some food. You have to try to exercise if you can. You know, movement, we know that exercise and movement is the number, I mean, I'm sure you've heard this a million times and everyone has, but it, you know, it is the number one most robust behavioral treatment, you know, to ward off depression and probably anxiety. And it's just a matter of trying to remind yourself that you're entitled to take care of yourself. I think people in these situations, and this is true in any kind of caregiving thing, which to go back to where we started, caregiving is a hazard for people who have traumatic histories, right? You know, they are people pleasers. They want people to like them. They're hypervigilant. So they're kind of always watching, okay, does somebody in my environment need me to do something, right? So it's as hard as it is, people have to really, and this is a lifelong journey, but people have to really work on paying attention to their own needs. And in terms of just complex trauma in general, what we talked about the last time I was on was this idea of not outsourcing our minds, being in our own minds and being in touch with our own needs. That's really crucial because, again, when there's a crisis, when somebody, you know, externally needs us, a lot of traumatized people, they're brilliant, right? They're brilliant caretakers. They can kick right into action, but that has a long-term psychic and physical cost. And so we really want people as much as they can to try to focus on their own needs and to focus on self-care as much as they can.
Yeah, that's really good. All right. I'm trying to think if there's anything else with regards. I mean, there's so much on this topic, but what I really want people to just walk away with is what you were saying, you know, really thinking about this idea of choice and knowing that actually they do have choice. They always have choice. And, you know, even if they may have to stand up to something that is different from maybe cultural expectations or societal expectations, but the importance to really listen to what you want to do. And I love when you said, think about, is this something that later on, you know, is this something that you would regret or be happy with? Like really to think that through. Right. Is empowerment in itself because you are making a choice here.
Exactly. I mean, I've known some people who've given up a lot and, you know, after it's over, they've said, okay, but I'm glad I did that, you know, but that's what you want is you want someone who's like, I'm glad I did that. You know, maybe they had the financial resources to not work, you know, or, you know, whatever they could, you know, take years off in some cases. But again, it's just trying as much as you can to plan ahead and think, you know, what am I going to give up now? What am I getting back? And is it worth it? And I think, too, just going back to this idea of trying as much as, you know, any of us can in that situation. And I know from experience how hard it is trying if you can to think about what am I wanting to get here and how realistic is it that I'm going to get it? Kind of going back to that idea of, what do we want from our parents and how likely is it that we're going to get it at this time?
That's really good. That's great. Tamara, tell us the name of the book that you wrote that has to do with chronic illness.
Yeah, it's old now. It came out in 2012, I want to say. Yeah, I think 2012. It's called When Someone You Love Has a Chronic Illness.
Mm-hmm. Great.
And it talks about these issues, but also what I really love about that book too, is it goes through a lot of really concrete things about how to be a medical patient.
Oh, that's good.
Yeah. Well, because, you know, I don't know. I imagine the system in Canada is a bit better than it is in America, but being a medical patient here is pretty tough. And so I give lots of concrete, you know, suggestions. So if you're a patient yourself, which we all are at some point, mm-hmm. that I give concrete suggestions about how to actually deal with doctors, how to deal with doctor's offices, how to deal with it when they interrupt you, how to, mm-hmm. you know, figure out how to plan a like treat a doctor's appointment like a business meeting so you can get what you need from it. You know, there's a lot of like, just because, you know, I worked in medical settings for so many years and I saw all the things that could go wrong. So I was trying to empower people because right. it's a tough system. It's a tough system to be yeah. up against.
That's great. You reminded me of my husband. He cracks me up. He always goes in with a pad and paper like a business meeting.
Yeah. Yeah.
Which I think is great. Yeah.
That's what I tell people to do because, you know, especially nowadays, doctors are overwhelmed. So I think secretly they appreciate us organizing them a little bit.
Yeah, for sure. For sure. All right. Well, thanks so much, Tamara.
All right. Thanks for having me.